Well, we'll get started. Good morning and welcome to this panel discussion on conservation easements and the preservation of private land. My name is Perry Backus. I've been covering natural resource and environmental issues in Montana for the past 25 years. I'm currently working at the Ravalli Republic. Montana is the big sky state. Its wide open vistas, towering mountains, and rivers filled with trout have been attracting people here for decades. Long ago, people recognized that unrestrained development could, and already has, changed the very nature of this place. In the mid-1970s, the Nature Conservancy accepted the state's first conservation easement of 1,800 acres in the Blackfoot Valley. Since then, grassroots efforts across Montana have helped preserve more than 1 million acres of private land from development. People from all walks of life have stepped forward to make that happen. Missoula County has passed two $10 million bonds to protect open space. In 2006, 58% of Ravalli County residents passed their own open space bond. A huge grassroots effort in the Blackfoot Valley has preserved about 400,000 acres of Plum Creek timberlands, but the challenges remain. The American Farmland Trust believes there are more than 5 million acres of Montana's best ranch land is still in peril from low-density development. Today, our panelists will provide some insight on the projects that have gone before and the challenges of moving future efforts forward. Our three panelists are Carolyn Bird, is the Western Montana Program Director for the Nature Conservancy of Montana. From her base in Missoula, Caroline's efforts have focused primarily on two landscape-scale conservation efforts called the Montana Legacy Project and the Blackfoot Community Project. Working with an array of partners and communities, Caroline has led the effort for the Nature Conservancy's purchase of about 400,000 acres of Plum Creek timberlands. Before moving to Montana, Caroline was the Nature Conservancy's Southwest Colorado Program Manager in Telluride. Before that, she served as a staff attorney and the Greater Yellowstone Program Director for the Wyoming Outdoor Council in Lander, Wyoming. While in Lander, she led national outdoor leadership courses that taught outdoor skills to students from the Rocky Mountains all the way to East Africa. Caroline has worked seasonally for the Forest Service as a wilderness ranger and trail crew in Wyoming and Alaska. She has an undergraduate degree in environmental studies and anthropology from the University of California, Santa Cruz, a master's degree in environmental studies from the University of Montana, and a law degree from the University of Montana School of Law. Wendy Nintman is the Western Director of the Land Trust Alliance. The Alliance is a national conservation organization that works with the nation's 1,700 land trusts. Wendy has more than 20 years of combined experience in land conservation, nonprofit management, and public relations. In 1998, she became Executive Director of the Five Valleys Land Trust in Missoula. Her leadership guided the fledgling community organization into a highly respected regional land trust. In 2006, the land trust successfully led the effort for passage of a $10 million open space bond in Missoula. Working with partners, the organization conserved the Alberton Gorge in 2004 and Missoula's Mount Sentinel in 2003. She has played a role in regional and national conservation, including serving as a founding member of the Heart of the Rockies Initiative, a group of land trusts from Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, and Canada created to share information, improve funding, and increase capacity to conserve landscapes in the Northern Rockies. Before all that, Wendy was an award-winning journalist who worked as assistant news director for KFUM Public Radio and for KECI-TV in Missoula. Mark Rose works with the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service state offices to manage more than 3,400 farm and ranch lands protection program easement acquisitions nationwide. These easements prevent more than 750,000 acres of farm and ranch lands from being converted to non-agricultural uses. Rose received an associate degree of applied science in crop production technology from the Agricultural Technical Institute and a bachelor's degree in agriculture from Ohio State University. During his 26-year career with NRCS, Rose has held numerous positions, including district conservationist in Ohio, resource Conservation and Development Coordinator in Southwest Oklahoma and Southern Maryland. Resource Conservation and NRCS's National Headquarters in Washington, D.C., and Assistant State Conservationist for Programs in Maryland. And if the panelists would like to come up, then.
So I'm going to start off, and as Perry said, I'm Wendy Nintman, and I can't resist giving Perry a plug, because when I worked at Five Valleys, Perry and I worked together on quite a few stories that he did, and it really was one of the few that really understood what a conservation easement was, because it's complicated, and just really did some wonderful work on behalf of the conservation easement community. So I want to thank you for that. And then also John Reimel, who my last conservation easement that we did while I was at Five Valleys was on his property, which is in the South Hills. And for those of you who aren't from around here, if you just look south and you can see that beautiful spread of ranch land going into timberland, there's three families up there that work together on a joint easement project that really secured that whole end of the Missoula Valley. So.
And Perry wrote the story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's a good one.
So I'm going to kind of cover the perfunctory, what is a conservation easement and what is a land trust, and I hope that isn't too boring for a lot of you in the audience, but I think it'll kind of set the stage for what Caroline and Mark are going to be talking about. So first of all, the Land Trust Alliance, as Perry said, it's now 1,700 land trusts across the country, and we are a membership organization, but we like to think of ourselves as servant leaders, and in other words, we're a lot more than a trade association. And we do provide training and education and support for our land trust members across the country. But more than that, we really think of ourselves as trying to lead the movement forward. And so we've initiated some programs such as standards and practices, which are national benchmarks for best business practices for a land trust. And then in the last couple of years, we've formed an independent program for accreditation. So for the last two or three years, land trusts across the country have started to go through that process of national accreditation. And then just this fall, actually last couple of weeks ago in Hartford, Connecticut, at our national meeting, the board passed a resolution to really embark on a conservation easement defense insurance program, which would be a captive insurance program owned by the land trust community that would help land trusts ensure themselves and their conservation easements, which are designed to last into perpetuity. So when I was thinking about private land conservation in the title for this session, I went to the website for this program and came up with, you know, here's this beautiful picture and this really beautifully written thing about Montana being the last best place, and the lyrical nickname talks about the iconic national parks and forests and free-flowing rivers and clear lakes and all those things that make this place such a special place, such a wonderful place. Then the last line, a microcosm for how the North American West is the nation's fastest changing region. And that's really, in a nutshell, that's why I think private land conservation and conservation easements are important, because the landscape is changing, and it's changing really fast and really dramatically. And this slide, Carolyn, you might know, but I think these are septic permits, the red dots. And the reason I put it up there is because the slide before that talked about those vast wilderness areas and the iconic landscape, grizzly bear habitat, what all those things depend on is a lot of what happens in these red areas, which are the valley bottoms and the uplands and the forest edge. And that's where all the development's happening. And you can see we're kind of right in the heart of that. You've got the Bob Marshall, you've got the Rocky Mountain Front, you've got the Bitterroot Selway Wilderness. You've got all kinds of core critical habitat areas that we depend on for clean water, for habitat, for the economy for so many reasons. And yet what happens in all of these areas that are full of red dots are really going to make a big difference in what the face of that landscape looks like in the future. Is this your land, John?
Yep.
Yes, it is. Okay. So a conservation easement, there's a lot of mythology around what a conservation easement is and what it is not. And I was going to start right off with that. Like, this is what they aren't. And I did a little research and I came across the Nature Conservancy's website, which has a really wonderful section on myths and then facts. And I really urge any of you who are interested in digging a little deeper into this subject that you check out the website. It was really an accurate presentation of the kinds of things you hear about conservation easements that really are not based in reality. And what they are, and why the two words are highlighted, voluntary and willing. So it's a legal agreement, although some of them are term easements, and I'm not sure if you'll be talking about that or not, but there are some programs that provide term easements. The land trusts generally are dealing with permanent conservation easements, and what they do is they restrict some uses of the property, and they limit the use of the property in order to protect the natural resources for perpetuity for the public. They're really flexible tools. One of the myths is that you, once you put a conservation easement on your land, that you're done, you locked it up, you can't work it, and as John will tell you, you can actually still run cows and cut trees and manage your land. You still own the land. You have the right to pass that land on to your children or to sell it. But future owners of that land will be restricted by the terms of the conservation easement.
A quick question about that last slide.
Yeah.
What was the Plum Creek, not the one before that, 25.7% of land owned by Plum Creek?
Yep.
What is Plum Creek?
Plum Creek is a timber company.
Okay.
And I'll be talking extensively about Plum Creek.
And I stuck this in here because I knew she was going to be talking about the Legacy Project, and it will be good to think about this slide when she gets there because they are a major landowner in Montana. And part of the project, the Legacy Project that Caroline will talk about, takes place on this slide. And this is John's picture that he took, also in the South Hills. And the land just above there is the land I was speaking to that's now protected. And I just thought this was, when I start thinking about why do landowners do conservation easements, this is a lot of reason why people do conservation easements, because they feel like, you know, their choice is if they can't afford to keep it working, they have to sell. So conservation easement provides, in some cases, and I'll get into that, some financial benefit for doing a conservation easement. This quote I thought was just a really accurate representation of what you hear when you talk to landowners around about the challenging situation they face. So this is picture of Mount Sentinel right behind the campus here, and this again was a project that was done by the land trust and the community and the county and city government to protect Mount Sentinel. So again, why would people do this? Well, again, 5,000 acres of land developed in the U.S. every day. That speaks to a lot of the reason. And the main reason we like to think people do conservation easements, certainly the reason the Rimal family did a conservation easement, is because they have a really deep connection to that piece of property. And they understand what the values on the property has for the public, that clean water, again, wildlife habitat, scenic, open space, forests. And so they really are, it really is this altruistic effort to do something good. In addition to the altruistic reasons, there are some pretty significant tax benefits to doing a conservation easement. And those happen in income tax benefits and also estate tax benefits. I'm not going to go into how that works, but basically, if you prove that there is public benefit attached with that conservation easement, and the law is pretty specific on what that means, and you meet the tax requirements, you're eligible for an income tax deduction. In addition to that, and in many cases, more importantly, there are some really significant estate tax benefits, because if you, when you put a conservation easement on your land, you're basically reducing the market value of that property. You're reducing or stripping away the development rights. So if a property is worth $1 million today and you put a conservation easement on it and the appraisal says there's a 50% reduction in value and it's worth $500,000, when you die and your estate goes into probate or whatever, that's the figure. They're going to be looking at that lower figure. And that's a big factor, although we don't know what's going to happen with estate taxes in the future. It has been a major problem for landowners in the West who want to keep their land in the family, and it's their heirs, frankly, can't afford to pay the estate taxes. So it's a great estate planning tool. So as far as what is a land trust, the reason I put this slide up is because land trusts, they're very different. They operate at very different scales. They each have a very unique focus. Sometimes they do trails, and sometimes they do just private conservation easements. This picture over here is an easement that was out in Grass Valley out by the airport, and that's a private conservation easement on a working ranch. The two slides to the adjacent are Mount Sentinel and Mount Jumbo, which are public land acquisitions that were facilitated through land trusts in this region. And I think one indication of sort of the importance of land trust work and a growing recognition of how the importance of that on the landscape is the President's America's Great Outdoors Initiative. And oddly enough, the first listening sessions in the country were here in Missoula. And the first one was up in the Blackfoot Valley, and then the next day, the second one was, I think it was in this room. It was either in this room or the next room. But again, I think that sentence, the effort will promote and support community-level efforts to conserve outdoor spaces. And as far as we know, that's the first time a president in a speech has referred specifically to the land trust community. So it's kind of a big deal for those of us in the land trust business. So here's, this sort of shows you where the land trusts are across the country. And you can see there's a lot of action on the coast, on both coasts, and then spread out a little bit, definitely in the mid part of the country. And then you can kind of follow the Rocky Mountains and see the region that I'm working in is the 14 states in the West. And this sort of breaks out in my region where all the land trusts are. You can see there's a lot of land trusts in California. And not so much in the Colorado Plateau, the more sparsely populated areas. And then this, I was up in Waterton for a conference on the crown of the continent a couple weeks ago, and someone had this drawing at the bottom. And I just thought it was so important in sort of describing what's going on with private land conservation. One of the trends is definitely, getting away from freckles on the map, little projects here and little projects there, and thinking more strategically about how those things all knit together into something really meaningful. And so there's lots of different scales of projects, and I mention that because, you know, we've got members in the Bronx who are doing community gardens, and those are incredibly important projects that are happening in those communities. And then we have one of the biggest conservation projects in the country, if not the biggest, which Caroline is going to talk to you about, the Legacy Project. And really, it doesn't matter which of those you're talking about. I think, and it'd be interesting to know if you think this is true, but I think in the last decade, there's been a real recognition that regardless of scale, it all starts in the middle there, the place-based conservation. And I think in the past, there were more efforts thinking that someone else is going to determine what's important in a community or what kind of conservation needs to happen and swoop in and get it done. And it just doesn't happen that way. There has to be community buy-in, has to be landowner driven and directed and reflect community priorities. So I really like that diagram, thinking that even if the scale is so much bigger, it doesn't change the fact that it's all about the people that live there. Other trends, because of climate change and habitat fragmentation, quality of life issues, traditional working lifestyles diminishing, I think there's more awareness that there's a real problem, and the stats certainly show that. I think there's been better effort to link the economic benefits of open space, and so that people can see that this is not just about a drain on property taxes, but this is something that really adds value to your community's economic well-being. And then the last trend, which Perry mentioned, has to do with the growing number of successful local, state, regional funding measures for private land conservation. And I think it's remarkable that in 2006, $20 million the voters approved, you know, voted yes to tax themselves in just these two little counties of western Montana. And the things that that triggered here for landowners who had been, you know, really wanting to do something, but not everybody can afford to donate a conservation easement and just get the tax benefit. A lot of traditional agricultural families don't have the income to make use of the tax benefit. So finding sources of funding to help compensate those people is critical. And that definitely is a trend. It is pretty amazing when you look at, I think it was in Minnesota, in 2008, which we were already well into this recession, that's now well over, I guess, they passed a constitutional amendment dedicating a portion of the sales tax to water and land conservation by 56% of the vote, and that was the affirmative voters. They had to check yes on that, and that's a bigger percentage than Obama got in that state, which I think is really kind of amazing. And that's another thing that is unique, I think, about this business, is that it really is bipartisan and generally stays away from advocacy-oriented issues and focuses on solutions that people can gather around and agree on. And I'm probably getting close, so I'll wrap this up. Just some quick slides to talk about right here. Perry asked me to kind of bring it home. You can see in the 30-some years, 70% increase in population, but 228% increase in the number of acres developed in Missoula County. And the Legacy Project, you know, that will change dramatically because the Legacy Project happens in, is it all in Missoula County?
Most of it.
Okay. And this is the project that Perry talked about, the open space bond. So I won't go too much into that. An article that ran in the paper around that time that I think really did make a difference in people's mind and thinking that they don't have to choose between a healthy economy and a healthy environment, that they can have them both. And then finally, as for, you know, why people are interested in private land conservation, this was one of the best quotes that I've ever heard about the business, and it was from our mayor after the open space bond passed. When we are dirt, this will still matter. And that, I think that says it all. It's really about protecting our way of life. And so that's all I have. And again, I just want to encourage any of you who get into writing about easements or private land conservation to really dig deep, because some of the mythology that's out there, and the big one is, you know, taking away our private property rights. Easements are taking away our private property rights. And you could really argue that an easement is the ultimate expression of private property right, because you're saying what's going to happen on that property after you're dead. So thanks for the chance to talk with you. I'm going to put yours up.
Caroline gave a nice segue into some of the things I'm going to talk about, and I'm with the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service, and the programs I'm going to talk about are our easement programs. our programs are authorized through the Farm Bill. Congress authorizes this Farm Bill or brings it to discussion typically once every 5 years. It used to be, I remember reading an article where the Farm Bill was typically put together in about 2 or 3 months by Congress, and now it takes 2 or 3 years to do the normal Farm Bill. We just recently have the 2008 Farm Bill, which was passed in May of 2008, and it provides authorization for programs not only that we implement, but all of USDA within the Farm Bill. And we are a portion of the Farm Bill, Title II, I believe it is that right, Sylvia?
Yeah.
Of the conservation of the Farm Bill is the conservation programs. There's a number of other titles, but food stamps, which a lot of people don't realize, and food nutrition fall under the Farm Bill. So a lot of funding with that comes from the Farm Bill as well. But what I want to touch on is the specifics of four of our easement programs under NRCS. And I apologize if I get too acronym happy, but I'm going to try to spell these out before I use the acronyms. But stop me if you have a question. Wetlands Reserve Program. This is probably the biggest program we have in under easements. And I'm going to start also by saying, and Caroline mentioned this, that all our programs are voluntary. The farmer comes in or the landowner comes in and asks to participate. And we'll go out and visit with them about that, just like a salesman would. But it's up to them to decide whether they want to do this or not. So nothing is regulatory. We're not a regulatory agency. And everything that we do is voluntary. But the Wetlands Reserve program focuses on marginal farmland that have what's called hydric soils or water-loving soils. And the idea is to restore these types of soils back to their natural and near-natural conditions, because they've been altered by man, either to change the water regime to allow them to farm it or pasture or graze it. So the Wetlands Reserve Program purpose is to restore those lands back to what they were. We enter into agreements. We can enter into a 10-year restoration agreement, which is restoring those wetlands. We basically pay for most of the restoration of that wetland. The landowner, it's on his land, so he donates that area to be done, and he wants to see that conservation happen. We have 30-year easements, which is the term easements Caroline mentioned. We enter into an agreement with the landowner and a restriction on the deed to restore those wetlands over a period of, and keep them in place for at least a period of 30 years. It's highly likely that that land won't be converted again, because 30 years from now, we don't really know what the laws and regulations are going to quite be, but we're going toward the direction of environmental sustainability. We also have permanent easements. So in perpetuity, under WRP, that land will stay in that program forever. The landowner still owns that land. We buy a lot of those rights away from him, but he still has that ownership. He still has the ability to use it within the program requirements. There could be opportunities for them to graze on that land. We have a new grazing pilot that was introduced this year. And he has to have a management plan to be able to sustain that land within the parameters of what the program requires. So we have 10-year restoration agreements, 30-year easements, and then permanent easements. Wetland Reserve began in 1992. To date, we have over 2.2 million acres enrolled nationwide and under easements. And we average about 150,000 acres per year of enrollment. And the last several years, within this past Farm Bill, the 2008 Farm Bill, we have averaged over 220,000 acres of enrollment into the program, which is a lot of acres, a lot of easement acres. I've already mentioned the grazing rights, reserve rights pilot, which allows the landowner to graze those areas. Yes, ma'am.
Do you have a breakdown of how much of that acreage is in the 10-year
No, we can get that. Yeah, I don't have it in my papers right now, but we'll get that for you. So, water rights, is a Western issue. In states that have those issues, we are working to have this addressed in our conservation easement deeds. So that way we can address any water rights that are necessary to be maintained that habitat on the WRP easement. So we have to negotiate these things up front prior to when this easement is put into place. So we're very aware of the water rights issue. That's another specific issue that's out west. Next program, Grasslands Reserve Program. This helps landowners to develop and restore and protect their rangeland, pastureland, and other grassland while still maintaining the land suitable for grazing. So this is a program that is specific to grazing. And if you have rangeland or and pastureland that is good for grazing, we can enter into a rental agreement, which basically we have 10, 15, and 20-year rental agreements. We're paying an annual rental per year for you to maintain that grassland. We also have permanent easements in perpetuity. So what we purchase is the rights, all the other rights, development rights, and any other rights that are associated with that. That farm or that ranch will be maintained in grazing in perpetuity for the life of the farm. Works very well in some of those areas that rely heavily on grazing. We jointly administer this program with our sister agency, Farm Service Agency. They provide the financial dollar. We provide the technical assistance on this. I've already mentioned the enrollment options, 10, 15, or 20-year rental contracts and permanent easements. Enrollment allows grazing that's consistent with maintaining the viability of the natural grasses. And management activities are permitted. Caroline, I think, pointed some of this out. That, the land is still being managed for what the landowner wants to do with it. And we also are very conscious of the wildlife habitat out there. So during nesting seasons for local species, and especially those that are threatened or endangered or species in decline, that's part of the management plan that the producer utilizes to help promote those species and keep them very viable in those areas. Fiscal year 10, some statistics on GRP. We have 317 rental contracts. Those are 89,000, a little over 89,000 acres for those. 72 easements enrolled for about 56,000 acres. And in fact, I want to point out we have Sage Grouse Initiative with Tim Griffiths and David Noggle up here can answer a lot of specific questions on sage grouse. But $5.7 million of GRP in fiscal year 10 went towards supporting the sage grouse effort. And keeping that land available for that. And then $1.4 million went to the lesser prairie chicken, which is a little farther south of here. Moving on, we have a very small program, Healthy Forest Reserve Program, that operates under 13 states. The states across the country within RCS submitted a proposal over the last year, and we were able to fund 13 of those proposals. The purpose of this is to assist forest landowners to restore, enhance, and protect the forest land resources. And again, these are on private lands. All the programs I'm talking about deal with private lands, not public lands. We have 30-year contracts. We also have 10-year cost-share agreements, and we also have permanent easements under the Healthy Forest Reserve Program. Most of the Healthy Forest Reserve states are in the East region, and I say east of the Mississippi. We have two states, West Oregon and California, in the west, are participating in the program, and then Great Plains states, Oklahoma, Michigan. Michigan's not quite Great Plains, but it's Midwest, and Arkansas, which is there in the south, southwest, southeast. This program requires very extensive negotiations and discussions and partnerships at the local level, because the state gets the funding and the authorization to implement the program, then the state has to go out and work with the local partners to find the landowner, to identify the landowners to participate. And the focus is threatened endangered species in the forest areas. There's a management plan. It allows landowner for protections, this management plans when it comes to threatened endangered species. And it just gives the landowner a lot of opportunities to be able to still manage his forests and also protect the habitat of those species that it's targeting. All easements in the program right now, all easement programs. I'm going to get ahead of myself here, but let me come back to that sticker here in just a minute. I got one more program I'm going to cover, Farm and Ranch Land Protection Program. That's one we deal with here on the land trust side extensively, as well as the local state government side. But FRPP was authorized in the 96 Farm Bill. We have 44 states participating in FRPP. And since 1996, $532 million of FRPP funds have been expended to preserve a little over 560,000 acres. And as Peter mentioned earlier, as of fiscal year 09, the end of 09, we had 2,706 parcels, and now we're well over 3,500 parcels in the program. The fiscal year 10 appropriation was $150 million, so that brings us up to about $682 million nationally since the life of the program. The entire value of all these easements that we have within the program, which includes a landowner donation, the local land trust or county or local government contribution, and our contribution from the federal side, comes to almost just a little over $1.9 billion of investment. And that's a lot of money and a lot of land preserved. We're approaching 920 million acres being preserved in the program as of fiscal year 10. The numbers quite aren't out yet. We're at the end of our fiscal year. But Wyoming and Colorado, our two biggest western states for this year, had a total of 170,000 acres in the program. For this year, 90,000 acres went to Wyoming and Colorado. Of course, a lot of that is benefiting the sage-grouse habitat in those states, it's a good fit. And then this year, just alone, we've acquired over 70,000 acres in fiscal year 2010. Now, back to what I was saying earlier, we have agents. As an agency, we have over 3 million acres of easements that we're managing, either directly or indirectly. Under WRP, NRCS holds that deed of easement, and we work with the landowner on that directly. Under FRPP, we rely on the partners, the entities. They hold the easement. We're there to help them if they need assistance in the future. We provide half the dollars to purchase that easement to the local entity. So it could be a land trust, it could be a local government.
Is this outside Montana or just in Montana?
That's all over the country. So I had the opportunity to visit two farms yesterday, Five Valleys Land Trust. I believe they're north of here. Drummond is the area. In fact, I think you were involved with those easements purchases. But two of those ranchers, they both are grazing operations. They're probably combined. They're around 6,000-7,000 acres, possibly, in that range. So these ranchers, they've protected their farm forever from development, from being split up. The one couple, they don't have any family, immediate family, to be able to pass this farm to. And their fear, when they're done being able to use the farm, what's going to happen to it? They want to keep it intact, and this program keeps it intact and also keeps development from happening. So that's the way. It's common across the country that way. Western states have a lot of large easements. Eastern states have a lot of small easements. And that brings me up to, I'm going to divide the country in about three areas within the United States, and that map that you had up earlier of all the land trusts. Mm-hmm. It kind of points out to where the dollars go for the program. 34% of the funding went to the western states, which, let's look at Montana and go straight south. You got Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico, I believe. I got the geography right. 10% of the funds, basically between that line to the Mississippi River, and then 57% went east of the Mississippi River. So there is interest in getting more dollars out here. And initiatives like what we have with Sage Grouse, NRCS, in this farm bill, and our chief are very interested in initiatives. Sage Grouse Initiative, the Mississippi River Basin Initiative, and even in this farm bill, the Congress authorized what's called the Chesapeake Bay Watershed Initiative and provided dollars directly to that, which I've been heavily involved with in the Chesapeake Bay. Agriculture is the best land use when it comes to the environment. There is places for development, and there's need for development. That sustains and keeps the local economies going, but also agriculture helps maintain the environment and keeps it sustainable as well as productive. And also as food security for us as well. So with that, I hope you're ready.
Mm-hmm. Did you want me to switch places?
Sure. Yes.
Nature Conservancy, and thanks for attending this conference and this this session. It's great that there is not a huge crowd, because I think this will be much more conversational, and we can do. How much time should I spend on this, because it would be great to have more kind of questions and a little bit more discussion, since we've got such a nice small room. But I'll try and make sure we can make this kind of conversational as we go, because I'd love also to know who you all are and where you're from. So I'll try and make sure that we have room for that. And also just pipe up if you've got questions as we go forward, because I think we can, between the three of us, we can have a more interesting discussion than just kind of talking at you this whole time. Well, I'm from the Conservancy. This is our mission. The Nature Conservancy is almost 60 years old. We got started in 1951. And we got started by a group of ecologists. And we are very much a science-based organization. And this group of ecologists back in the East decided that they were concerned about rare and endangered plants, primarily. And they decided that they would take a new approach to protecting rare and endangered plants, and that is that they would buy the land where you found the plants. Voila! The plant is protected because we own the land. And we started doing preserves that way. But it's a science-based organization, and as the Nature Conservancy evolved, we pretty soon realized that there are limits to how much you can buy, both because it's kind of that freckly approach of like, oh great, we've protected the fringed lily over here, but the bog orchid over there, you know, after a while you can't buy it all. But the idea, the thinking evolved in, let's look at protecting important places for both plants and animals throughout the country. We started out as a very, as the conservancy grew, it went from state to state, and before we knew it, we were in all 50 states, and that was looked at as a huge accomplishment. Well, now, as we keep questioning ourselves and asking, are we doing, in fact, anything to meet this tremendously ambitious mission, we're now a global organization, and we're working around the world and looking at areas that have important conservation values. Because we're led by scientists, we always have to analyze what we're trying to do. What are we trying to protect? Well, we're trying to protect biodiversity on the planet. Okay, well, that means the whole planet doesn't really actually contain the biodiversity that we're trying to protect. A lot of it's already urban or developed or agricultural, and so we have to be strategic about where we work. And so we go through this whole eco-regional planning assessment of where on the planet should we be working? Where are there things that we should be protecting? Okay, once we've identified where we should work, how do we protect these elements of biodiversity, plants, animals, communities that need protecting? What's their threat? So that's, we're always asking, what are we trying to protect? What's the threat to those things that we're trying to protect? When we look at what the threats are, okay, what strategies do we need to come up with to abate these threats so that we can protect what it is we're trying to protect? Okay, and then we come up with our strategies. We put them in place because we're a very action-based organization. We like, there's great resources in studying and doing scientific analysis. That's what universities are great resources for. But we try to actually do the action. What is that strategy that's going to abate the threat that's threatening the thing we're trying to protect? So we put in force these strategies. And then, of course, we have to monitor those strategies. Is what we're doing effective? If it's not effective, we better change it. If it is effective, yippee, but is there more that we could be doing? So that's kind of the cycle of how we work. But we also realize we are a very large organization as far as conservation organizations go. We're the biggest conservation organization in the world, but you know, that's not saying a lot when you look at big organizations worldwide. I mean, the biggest conservation organization in the world employs 3,000 people. You know, that's not that big. I mean, there are a lot of companies that are very small companies that employ 3,000 people, but we're the biggest conservation organization in the world, and we realize very quickly that we cannot do it alone. There's not enough money or people in the Nature Conservancy itself to take on, again, this very ambitious mission. You have to work in partnerships. Federal partnerships, land trust partnerships. across the board partnerships. We work with everybody, anybody and everybody who makes sense to come up with a good strategy to protect, to be effective conservationists, we will work with. You've got to work in partnership. And the other thing we realized as we were marching across the country and then expanding into the world, and Wendy mentioned this, you have to work with your communities. You have to work in the places that you're trying to conserve. You have got to work with the communities that live there. If you don't, you're wasting your time and your money. It's community-based conservation that's effective, lasting, and tangible. And the best conservation that we can help work with, or that we work with, are the conservation projects that the communities look at and say, we did this. This is our project. This is our work. That's the goal of the Nature Conservancy, is to help have that happen. We're very non-confrontational. We don't bring lawsuits. We work in partnership. We work with communities. We work with the federal government. We do try and affect policy. We work with the Farm Bill as well as other initiatives at both the state, local, and federal, national level. We do work on policy. But now I'm going to talk to you now about what we're doing in Montana and why working with private land and with public land in Montana is actually, I think, because it's my job, it's one of the best things you could possibly be doing, and I feel like I have one of the best jobs on the planet. How many of you are from Montana? Great, not very many, so this is my chance to beat the Montana drum, which is actually really easy to do. You might have noticed as you've been here in Missoula that this is a really lovely place. But it's more than just a really pretty place. It's actually a very important, on a global scale, it's a very important place for conservation. When you look at this map of intact ecosystems in North America, and what I mean by intact is we haven't lost any of our species, plant or animal, or plant or animal communities, they're still here. What Lewis and Clark saw when they came through this part of the world is still here. And unfortunately, that's extremely rare, not just in North America, but in on the globe. There are very few intact ecosystems. And you can see on this map, we are here. We are part of this, what we call the crown of the continent. And I think you'll hear that term more and more, the crown of the continent being glacier and the Bob Marshall wilderness systems and Watertown kind of at the core, those very protected federal land surrounded by national forests, surrounded by private land is a great generalization, but it's this northern Rockies from Montana up into Canada was what we call the crown of the continent. It's one of the main places in Montana we work. The Nature Conservancy works in four places in Montana. Here in the crown of the continent. We also work out here in the northern plains, in the grasslands, where there are such great bird resources as well as other phenomenal resources. We work down here in southwest Montana and on the Yellowstone River. But we have probably our biggest project is here in the crown of the continent. I put these pictures of these animals up because those are kind of the iconic megafauna that we have here. We have grizzly bears. We have thriving grizzly bears. Wolves are actually doing phenomenally well here, and we're the last and best stronghold for Canada lynx in the lower 48 is right here in the crown of the continent. And I'm going to talk first about I didn't do a very good job of putting the map together of where in the crown we work, but I'll start here in the Blackfoot. The Blackfoot River Valley is right at the southern end of the crown. It's actually, if you went just a little bit east of Missoula, you'd run smack into the Blackfoot River that runs into the Clark Fork River, which is the river that runs right through town here. The Blackfoot River then just extends another 132 miles up to the Continental Divide. But the Blackfoot River Valley is at the southern end of the crown of the continent. And I love this map, even though it's a crazy quilt of colors and kind of makes you cross-eyed and you don't really know what you're looking at. But what you're seeing here is the 1.5 million acre watershed of the Blackfoot. And why I like it so much is this this crazy quilt of colors is the land ownership pattern. And what's also so baffling to me about this as a lover of Western history is it talks eloquently, this map, about how the West was settled. The laws that were passed to get people out into the West and all of the movements that we've had as a nation for land ownership and land settlement patterns. Briefly, what we're looking at, the green is national forest. The dark green is wilderness. The Wilderness Bill, of course, passed in 1964. That's the Scapegoat Wilderness. North of the Scapegoat is the Bob Marshall, one of the original and biggest wildernesses we have in North America. Bob Marshall, of course, worked for the Forest Service and started the wilderness system, really, and became the first president of the Wilderness Society. And so it's wonderful that we have our wilderness named after Bob Marshall. And he's got to be really proud of that. So the National Forest, that was land that was established. I'm not going to get too far into this. Stop me now, because otherwise I'll spend half 2 hours talking about that. But so there's national forests in the green. This yellow is Bureau of Land Management, kind of the leftovers of federal land. And we do have quite a bit of BLM land in western Montana. The blue, the dark blue, is state land. And when Montana became a state, we got two sections per township for state land. And that's another, I'll just briefly talk about. See, each one of those squares is a square mile. It's a section. Why we have a checkerboard across our landscape in the West when we're a mountainous terrain really makes no sense, but it is what it is, and it's how we divide up land. We divide it up in squares, and each square mile is a section. So we got, as a state, we got every other, or we got sections 13 and 36 across the state. Those are those dark blue squares. The light blue squares is Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, also state land, but our state Fish and Game Agency. This is Blue Breath National Forest. It's owned by the university. It was donated to the university by Plum Creek Timber, which I'm getting to. The white is the private land. Most of it was homesteaded long, long ago, back under the Homestead Acts. It was homesteaded because it's that good valley bottom. It's got great grass, it's got the water, it's where you can run cattle, it's where you can establish a livelihood, a home, a town, a community. This white land, I don't know if you can see it from back there, but a lot of the land in the Blackfoot has got this crosshatching on it. Those are conservation easements. More than 130,000 acres of private land in the Blackfoot is under conservation easement. And that's a wonderful story in and of itself, but it has to do with the communities that live there, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, land trusts like Five Valleys, and on and on. But it's a really lovely story, and the Blackfoot Channel, well, anyway, stop me now. So, get to the gist of the matter. This pink land and the salmon-colored land is Plum Creek timber land. Plum Creek timber, all of that land was railroad land, or was transferred from railroad land. Railroad land was established by Abraham Lincoln in 1862 to get the railroads, to build the railroads across the country, to bring people out west and to defend our country. Railroad land, it went from the railroads to Anaconda Copper Company, to Burlington Northern, Champion Timber, and in 1992 or 3, Plum Creek Timber bought all the railroad land, almost all the railroad land in Montana. They have 1.2 million acres of the state. It's private land, which is important to remember. Plum Creek Timber is the largest private landowner in the country. They own 8 million acres nationwide, but 1.2 of it, the largest chunk of any state, was here in Montana. Timber, as you all know, we live in a global economy. Plum Creek Timber Company was seeing the global market for timber decline here in Montana. Our timber was basically driven by the mines in Butte. That's why Anaconda Mining Company bought so much timberland. as timber, the value of timber and the economy for timber, the market for timber was declining, the market for residential, for real estate in Montana and the West was skyrocketing. For most of the 90s, from the mid-90s on, we were seeing a 15-20% rise in land prices in Montana. Why? Because it's beautiful. And because people, especially baby boomers, where do they want to retire? Poll after poll shows that people want to retire in the Rocky Mountain West. Where are the two places they want to retire? Colorado and Montana. Where was the land cheaper, even as it was going up? Montana. So we were seeing this tremendous influx and drive of demand for private property, demand for these ranches and ranchettes. And that, to be perfectly honest, is one of the biggest threats to conservation we have in this part of the world. So here we are, the Nature Conservancy, trying to protect the Blackfoot River Valley because of its fisheries, its grizzly bears, the wetlands and riparian areas, and that one of the biggest threats is fragmentation from residential, dispersed residential development. Think of Wendy's map of all of those septic tanks sprinkled throughout the valleys. Each one of those represents a house, a road, people living there with their dogs and cats and bringing in invasive species. Why is that a threat to conservation? Because grizzly bears and people don't get along. Wolves and people don't necessarily get along. It's one of our biggest threats to conservation. So what we, the Nature Conservancy, going back to how we work hand in glove with our communities, in the Blackfoot, there's an organization called the Blackfoot Challenge. As a member of the Blackfoot Challenge, we all saw this threat to the viability of that valley as Plum Creek started to sell their land. In fact, they reincorporated themselves from a timber company to a real estate investment trust. So the writing was on the wall, and they, in fact, as members of the Blackfoot Challenge, had told us, this land is going to be for sale. So our response was, well, let's buy it. Kind of going back to 1951 and those ecologists back in Massachusetts. Let's buy it. Let's protect it. Let's buy it. Well, so that's what we did. We bought 89,000 acres of Plum Creek land in the Blackfoot River Valley for $70 million. And that's where the Nature Conservancy, as the largest, as a large group, that's where we can add value to local projects. We have the borrowing power to actually write a check for $70 million. Now, we have to pay for that. We're in debt for that. We have to either fundraise for that, or we have to work with the federal government to buy that land. We have to now sell that land. We're not going to keep the land. We just want to protect it. And so as we moved forward with the Blackfoot Community Project, we transferred a lot of this land to the Forest Service, a lot of it to the Bureau of Land Management, a lot to the state, both the NRC and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. But we also worked, I think 20% of the land went to private landowners, adjacent landowners, primarily ranchers. We sold them our land with a conservation easement, but at the same time, we used money from NRCS or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or other federal sources of funding to buy an easement on their land. Like Wendy mentioned, a lot of people aren't in a position to donate an easement. They need a purchased easement. So we would purchase an easement on the adjoining ranch. They would use that money to buy our land that also had an easement on it. So as we were working on this project in the Blackfoot, we heard loud and clear from other valleys nearby, both the Swan, Potomac, and other places, that said, called in the Nature Conservancy and said, we want you to do that here too. We also have 80,000 acres of Plum Creek land in our valley. It is up for sale. We don't want to see what we have, this intactness, these incredible natural values, we don't want to see that die the death of 1,000 subdivisions. We want our places protected. So from the Blackfoot, we went into our next project, which is called the Montana Legacy Project. And I like that name, I mean, even though it sounds somewhat generic, but it's addressing a legacy and it's creating a legacy. It's addressing that legacy of railroad lands. what you can clearly see on this map is that checkerboard, which is a crazy way to own and manage land in a checkerboard. If you're the Forest Service here in Lolo Creek, and you own every other square of the checkerboard, you own the red squares, and somebody else owns the black squares, and you're not of the same, you don't have the same management principles, you have very different philosophies of how to manage your land, your hands are tied. What we've done with the Legacy Project in buying this 310,000 acres from Plum Creek for an even bigger price tag of almost $500 million is we are buying or have bought the bulk of this land. We were able to do that in a large part because of the Farm Bill. And this last Farm Bill had a provision in it called the Forest Conservation Bonds, which we applied for and then obtained $250 million in order to pull off this project. With that $250 million bought were all the green squares up there. All of that green land we purchased with the money from the Farm Bill. We purchased it from Plum Creek. A year and a few months later, we transferred all of that green land to the Forest Service. It's all now public land owned by the forest. The adjacent forests, the Lolo National Forest and the Flathead National Forest. This green checkerboard is now erased. That is all Forest Service land. The red land, the remaining land of the MLP, acronyms, will go either to state, primarily state. This land here, Fish Creek, has already gone to Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. We're about to sell this land to DNRC. This piece, which has the highest density of Canada lynx in the lower 48 states, will also go to Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. And then that upper part that's surrounded by blue, which is state forest, will go to the Swan River State Forest. It will also go to DNRC. So as we're working through this over the next few years, it's kind of about buying and then quickly, we're not holding this land for long. We'll quickly be putting it into the hands of primarily state and federal land management agencies. This is just, again, what it looks like. We're buying it in three phases. We're about to buy that phase three, the Gold Acres. We'll buy that in December. And then I just want to also talk about the east side of the Crown of the Continent, the Rocky Mountain Front. And here's a very, it's of a more traditional kind of approach to land protection. On the Rocky Mountain Front, and it's the eastern side of the Crown of the Continent. This is where grizzly bears are out on the plains, where they always used to be. This is where it's been called the American Serengeti. It's got some of the highest wildlife values in North America over there on the front. And if you haven't ever been there, I highly encourage you to go. It's one of the most scenic, awe-inspiring landscapes in the lower 48. But what we do in the Rocky Mountain Front is work with the communities, work with the landowners, work with the ranchers. These are primarily very traditional, multi-generational ranchers. And what we've done is, by working there for decades, building trust, working on things like weeds, and slowly introducing the idea of conservation easements to a very conservative community, and what they, as we work with them and as they see their neighbors put conservation easements on their land, as they see how it works, as they see how you can still graze, you can maintain your living, and in fact, it can help you by providing funds to keep your land in your family. The easements have spread, and we now have, our goal is to protect 250,000 acres of land on the Rocky Mountain Front. And what this all adds up to, and I should mention too, Wendy mentioned this idea of landscape scale. And the Nature Conservancy, federal government, everybody working in conservation has realized that to really affect lasting conservation, it has got to be at this scale. The freckles, the small easements that aren't linked together, doesn't cut it in the long run. They will become islands, and we know what happens to islands when they're surrounded by development. What we can do here in Montana what we have the opportunity to do and what we're, I think, doing a fine job of pushing along is truly landscape scale conservation. We have the opportunity because on the west side we have one landowner who owns the vast majority of private land, that's Plum Creek Timber. Not to say we aren't also working with the other landowners and in partnership with all the other organizations that are doing that work. And then on the east side, on the Rocky Mountain front, we have large ranches, large land holdings by ranching families. And so bit by bit, we can actually work to keep this place knit together. I think this is a remarkable map in showing the progress that's been made since 1996 to 2010 in protecting private land in the Crown of the Mountain. I think that's it, and that's what I never even once looked at my outline to see if I actually did the things that I'm supposed to. But I would much rather hear from you and have more of a discussion of questions and answers.
Well, we're kind of in at the end of our period, but if you guys want to stay a little bit longer and visit, ask some questions, be great.
I had a question regarding the Wetlands Reserve Program.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that it's that farmers that aren't making enough money could possibly sign on for the 10-year restoration program, cash in on that, and then move back to farming that land, which would kind of defeat the purpose of restoring it. But is that a problem? And if so, what is the agency doing to prevent farmers from doing that?
The Wetlands Reserve, on the 10-year restoration, what we as an agency would do, and work in partnership with other state and local agencies, would be to restore that wetland area that has been farmed. So really, if the farmer wants to do this, and he's going to have to be committed to it, because he's not getting any financial gain out of this. We're basically paying for the ability, the work to restore it, and that's it. He covers 25% of it if he wants to. So otherwise we get other partners to help pay for it as well. But to do the 10-year restoration, that's all we're doing is restoring that wetland that's on that farm, so it won't go back into production. He doesn't want to produce that. And he may not get anything from it to begin with. The 30-year easement, that's the one where we hopefully, when we get the restoration done, it's going to restore that area to what it was. Now, he's going to get financial gain from this because we're putting an easement on his property and or their property. So that way, that'll be 30 years where it needs to be stay into that program. It's very highly likely that will be maintained as wetland area once it comes back out. Now, there may be an opportunity to take a buffer area and turn it back into production, but it needs to be sustainable with what's around the wetland as well. And of course, permanent easement, it won't go back.
And it can be a good partnership, again, as Caroline mentioned, with the local land trust, who may not have money to purchase an easement from somebody like that, but that you can overlay a permanent conservation easement with the land trust on top of a WRP, so that way they get some money, but when the WRP is up, they're still permanent.
I was going to ask about just a little bit more about working with private landowners and some of their motivations. You know, what is it that kind of brings a level of trust to kind of these negotiations? Is it word of mouth? You know, how are these kind of programs spreading? And then has the economic downturn had any effect in interest in conservation teams or conservation programs?
I mean, I think working with private landowners and how to build that trust, it's a long process. I mean, we've been working on the Rocky Mountain front since the 80s, we've been working in the Blackfoot since the 70s. And what it takes is being there, you know, understanding how these communities work and then participating and being respectful listeners and supporters. And I think the worst thing you can do, the death knell of getting anything done, is to swoop in and try and say, "We're here. We're here to help you." And to not listen. You've got to listen and participate and build that trust, and you've got to earn it. You have to follow through on what you say you're going to do. You have to have some on the ground to success to point to, and you have to build those relationships. And you build the relationships by getting to know one family or one group or one person and going from there, just like any other community work. And then it's really about letting the community members, the private landowners, lead and listening and taking your TNC hat off when you go into these valleys and work with the folks and work with the people. And listening to your partners as well and agreeing to agree on what we can all agree on and just leaving the contentious stuff over there. Because once it gets introduced, it doesn't work. And I think Montana has some remarkable examples of communities pulling together and working together in a very nonpartisan way.
I think I just add the driver, like why people do it, and John could answer that better than we could because he did it. And it really breaks into two major reasons. And one really does have to do with this connection that they have. They may not see themselves as conservationists or environmentalists for sure, but they have a deep connection there, and they want their kids to inherit that land perhaps, but maybe they're worried about, you know, in a way it's a gift to your kids because you're taking that option away, so that when three kids inherit the property and have to decide together, what are you going to do with it? That's one option that's not on the table. So I think there's that. I mean, it sounds trite, but that it is. It's mostly that deep connection. And then the other piece is the tax, the financial benefits, you know, estate tax, income tax, and then, you know, some of these, fortunately, government programs and bond measures and other resources, some financial compensation. And I don't think the recession, the numbers have not gone down. Because at the same time the economy's been going down, the development threat in this part of the world, especially in the Rocky Mountains, is people are really, when people start seeing it in their own neighborhood, that's when things change. And that's what's happened here, is that people, I think the countywide bond was the fact that it passed by 70%. And, you know, the county, our rural communities are not in good financial shape, but they still, every precinct but one, voted in support. And it was because the change was happening to them. It wasn't just in Missoula and urban area.
From the federal side, it is a challenge for our federal staff to, you have to gain that trust in the local community. We have an office pretty much in every county in the nation. And we have local people that live in that community, and they're the ones that are trusted. It's every day when I hear somebody from a field office or go out and visit with somebody, like yesterday when I was out on the Iversons and the Petersons ranch that Wendy worked with. They have the trust in that local office, and they trust them and look to them for the assistance and the technical knowledge to be able to do things. So you know, you hear a lot of things about federal government and so forth, but those local people live there and work there and have a bond and a relationship. That's how conservation gets on the ground. And it's also the word of mouth, because I think it was the Peterson family was talking about another farm next to them that they were talking about with the landowners to get into conservation easement. So, yes.
Thank you all. It was, aside from the intact ecosystem map, all very encouraging. I was trying to understand, if you took a hypothetical farmer rancher, sort of on the patchwork field, how do you use the USDA and the land trust collaborate or compete? You mentioned some things where they co-fund some of these, but as a typical deal flow, if you were a farmer, do you go to the land trust first, or do they go to the USDA and you bring in the land trust, or how does that swing back and forth?
It really varies.
It does.
On the relationship.
In both ways. Yeah, because yesterday I asked Mrs. Peterson, mm-hmm. Where did you start? And they said they went to the land trust. Mm-hmm. I've had field offices call me, how do we get these people into the program? And I have actually a message this week from a landowner from what state it is, but she's wanting to know more about conservation easements. Now, to participate directly in our farmland easements, they have to go through another entity. We don't fund them directly. We have to fund through the land trust or the county government, the state government, to do that. But we have that connection and partnership. That's been, and Caroline mentioned it, partnerships are very important. You can't do it without it, and we realize that.
So the land trust would be a sub, not grantee.
Well, they're a cooperator. We provide them with the dollars to be able to purchase that.
The land trust would do the application on behalf of the landowner, put together all the funding package, kind of act as the landowner's representative. But I don't think there's ever a competitive kind of feeling there. It's definitely, and Caroline said that really well. It's a partnership, and it often takes all the pieces.
There's more demand than money available for our particular programs.
And that's a good point, too. I mean, there is an opportunity right now because land prices are lower and the development demand has really dropped. And so now's the opportunity, but we don't have the money because that's also dropped. But not from the federal side. I think from the federal side, that's going to be a real source of addressing this opportunity we're in right now. There's the Great Outdoor Americas. There's this push to fund LWCF, Land and Water Conservation Funding, to its full level, which may or may not get through Congress by the end of the year. But if that does, now that would, the timing would be perfect, because we can, if we had the resources to address this opportunity we have right now, we could really get a lot done.
This also gives me an opportunity to just mention the Know Your Food, Know Your Farmer campaign USDA had. I don't know if anybody's heard of that, but that is to make a link between the farmer and the food community. And yesterday I learned that there's a number of farms, I believe, south of here, Hamilton area, that they're smaller scale, and smaller scale around here is, what, 150, 200 acres? But the smaller scale farms are providing food to this region, and that connection needs to be made. Unfortunately, the land trust doesn't have the ability yet under our programs to go down there and help purchase easements. I believe there's funding on the match side. Now we need to work with the land trust and identify the dollars on our side to come down there and be a partner to help get some of those conservation easements in place, because that's food security in the area. Right. That happens a lot as well.
Questions for Caroline. I'm just curious about when you turn over the land to, you know, the Forest Service or state agencies, because, you know, they're managing for multiple uses. Do you have any agreements in place about how they're going to manage that land in perpetuity?
No, we don't. Especially with, not with the Forest Service or the BLM, we don't. But the one thing I want to point out is this map, the Crown of the Continent, and it's the core of it, of course, is wilderness. But the reason why we have an intact ecosystem here, one of the reasons, of course, it's very complex, is because we have a lot of federal land. And in our estimation, in our analysis, the threat to biodiversity in the Northern Rockies is not from anything the Forest Service is doing. The threat is dispersed residential development and the lack of fire, which also is hand in glove with dispersed residential development. You've got homes out there, you can't have fire. And invasive weeds, and all of that. But in all of our scientific analysis, the threats are not from the federal land. They're from private. They're from development. So we feel, we have to go through a very rigorous process before we sell land to make sure that it does have a conservation outcome. If we're selling it to the Forest Service, BLM, Fish, Wildlife and Parks, or GNRC, we're good.
As far as some of the local projects that have used bond money, that's an issue too, you know, because what Mount Sentinel and Mount Jumbo are good examples. Now the city or the Forest Service owns them, and the level of protection that the land trust got was from the source of funding. The open space bond was paid for with those dollars, and the city would be in a huge amount of trouble if they converted the use, because they used those funds that were designed for a specific purpose. Same with land and water conservation funding or farm bill money. That's the land trust, which Nature Conservancy is a member of the land trust community, a very important member. That's a big, I think, role that the land trust community has, is to be that kind of watchdog into perpetuity and what happens to those lands.
And the other thing I'll mention, too, is that the agencies in all of these communities sit at the table. The LACA challenge, the both district rangers, Forest Service district rangers are there at the table. The BLM area manager is there at the table. Same in the SWAN with the SWAN Ecosystem Center. Same on the Rocky Mountain Front Advisory Council. They're integrated into these communities too. It's like the local NRCS field representatives. And there are a lot of oversight and involvement comes because they are part of those community roundtables or whatever it might be. And if the Forest Service, you know, they, people know what they're up to. And so there's a great assurance from that as well.
I know earlier you mentioned that with that patchwork, it's very difficult for, especially for the federal agencies to manage land and manage their neighbor with private. And so I know that they would be interested in acquiring land to fix that patchwork issue. But is it also, do you ever see resistance from the federal agencies because they already have so much, they have limited capacity for management? I imagine there's a limit.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and we get asked that a lot. All of the budgets of all the agencies are stretched really thin. So in some ways, though, by erasing that checkerboard and getting rid of those inholdings, it allows them to be more efficient with the money they have and manage better. But you bring up an excellent point, and I think it's something that all of us are aware of and working on is also bringing more resources and funding to our federal and state land management agencies so that they can do more restoration work, so that they can do more stewardship work, so that they can do more weed work and all of the work. I mean, it's one thing to protect the land by changing its land ownership, but the other job that we have to do here is to make sure and enhance what we have on this landscape. Because we're looking at climate change, we're looking at big changes. There's a lot of stewardship and restoration work that needs to be done. You know, if I was a young student at the University of Montana again, I would be studying restoration because I think that's where the future is and that's where the jobs are going to be, and I think that's where we're going to be looking as well. And I think the agencies realize that, and that partnership, we're all going to have to work together on management and stewardship and restoration of public and private land.
With that, I think we probably should wrap it up. Thank you for all the great information, and thank you for good questions.